Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And hey, we are back live after a couple of best of as we celebrated what needed to be celebrated. I appreciate all the usual suspects who are coming back. Join us live, and also those, the majority of you, of course, who get us either via the podcast or just get the download of the archive from Blog Talk Radio. For those that are with us live, I'd invite you to go ahead and join the chat room over at the bottom of the page. If you have some observations as the show goes along, or if there are some questions, comments, or points of order you'd like to bring up, that's a great place in order to do it. Both Eagle One and I will be keeping an eye on the chat room during the show, and if you come up with a brilliant pebble, we'll grab it, give it a good shine, and try to fold it into the conversation as soon as we can. Now let's get on with the show. As we mentioned in some of the work up to this week's show, we have a great guest today to kind of give us a snapshot of where we are now in one theater and pray to discuss a few larger issues, some bigger pixel items going forward. Because we have Afghanistan that, for lack of a better description, at least for the American side of the equation, is winding down this phase of the operation. But there's a lot in the global security environment that's in front of us that's being influenced by a lot of domestic priorities and challenges as well. And our guest to discuss all those items and perhaps a bit more is retired U.S. Army Colonel Dr. Joseph J. Collins. He is a professor of national security strategy at the National War College. He also served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Stability Operations and a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic International Studies, where he did research on economic sanctions, military culture, and also national security policy. He is a published author in a variety of locations. You can go on Amazon and Google him up. He also has a lot of work online and on Dead Tree publications, many of which you can get via the same means. He is author of one of his books, is Understanding War in Afghanistan. Joe, welcome to Midrats.
Great to be here. Nice to be here with you and Sal, and greetings to you also, Mark.
When we were trying to find a good weekend to bring you on, Joe, and again, it's a great opportunity to have you here. You mentioned, well, we may have to adjust our timing a bit. You're going to be off on a seminar. Now, when a lot of people think of war college seminars of one kind or another, it usually involves lots of cups of coffee and having your tushes grow roots somewhere. But the seminar that you were off in was a little bit of a different kettle of fish. You were off in a seminar in Afghanistan. So I just wanted to take a lead off here to get some of the fresher information from you. Who did you take with you to Afghanistan, and what was your area of focus?
Great, Sal. We had 10 students from the National War College, everyone from the National War College in two of the last 4 weeks that they're there conducts international travel. And normally it's to places like East Africa, West Africa, Latin America, and whatever. Last year, 2011, I went to Afghanistan as a guest of the NATO training mission Afghanistan. When I came back, we developed a new program at National called the AFPAC Fellows, and we had 10 officers in the AFPAC Fellows, four Army officers, all with great combat experience, one Marine who came in as volunteer, two Air Force, and two Navy. It was just a fantastic group of people, many of whom, three of whom, have had tremendous experiences as AFPAC hands in Afghanistan, spoke local languages, and whatever. The focus of our trip was on transition. And the transition in question would be the transition from ISAF lead in security to the Afghan lead in security. And that was also the focus of my trip in 2011. So, you know, I'm trying to sort of develop a, you know, a comparative base of the things that we saw. So that's what we were up to. And we were hosted by the NATO training mission Afghanistan, this great commander, Lieutenant General Dan Bolger. And he insisted that rather than standing around getting a lot of PowerPoint briefings in Kabul, that we get out and hit the road and see for ourselves what was going on. So in 7 days on the ground, we did eight provinces. And a few of my students referred to it as the air medal tour of Afghanistan. And as a result of this, a bit of tourism, we, of course, write reports, and the students develop a joint briefing on future strategy. And each of the fellows who went with us also, in his final oral exam for the college, had to give a briefing on Afghan strategy.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the monograph you wrote on the war in Afghanistan and what lessons you may see now that have been learned since the time you wrote that that publication.
Well, what I set out to do in the academic year, FY10 to 11, was to write a book that would be a intellectual primer for officers, senior NCOs, and junior diplomats going to Afghanistan for the first time. And I didn't want to tell them all sorts of practical things about this kind of custom or how do you say put your hands up in Dari or anything like that. What I wanted to do was to sort of give them the you know, the historical and political background that they would need to just sort of lead into the situation wherever they would be. And, I've been writing on Afghanistan since 1980, so I had plenty of material on the old stuff. But when it came, to the current events, it was fun to really sort of catch up with every conceivable database that we could bump into. But the really hard part for me was talking about the future, because the book was published in July 2011, and I had to make sure that the parts about the future were specific enough to be useful but general enough so that they wouldn't have to be updated every few days. In terms of the basic lessons, in terms of approach to the situation in Afghanistan, one of the things that we did in our class this year with our seminar, the same guys we took to Afghanistan, was we sort of force-marched through Afghan history over a three-class period from Alexander the Great up until, the early 2000s. And in doing that, every two or three students was given an era, and they were asked to sort of, state at the end of their presentation, what were the threads that you found? And the threads that we found, the most remarkable one, it's so obvious, it often eludes a lot of Americans. Americans are fond of saying, we've been at war in Afghanistan for 10 years. True enough, that is true about the United States. But Afghanistan is a small, underdeveloped country that's been at war for 34 years. Afghanistan tends to be a place where there are lots of internal wars and external wars. It's a poor country. It's underdeveloped. It's never really sort of agreed on what modernization is going to look like there. And it's a country that is susceptible to political instability. One thing we get through our forced march through history is the fact that, you know, Afghanistan has had less than a dozen rulers in the 20th century, but only one of them has left office, in a suitable manner, actually died in his sleep, and that was in 1901. And pretty much the rest of them have either been forced out and killed, or they've been forced out through some other method of unpleasantness. And so this is the sort of things that we, you know, pick up in our study. And, by looking at the current events, we can sort of judge the transition. We can also look at the problems that have existed and get a pretty good roadmap to the problems that have to be solved for the future.
I like the phrase you use, force marching through history. I think in the profession of arms, sometimes people get so stuck on the technology, the gadgets, and the latest buzzword that they forget that maybe they need to do a little bit of more force marching through history and a little less looking at the differential equations. I'd love to have seen that on video of some way. You ought to get that up on YouTube or something. But when I was there back in 08 and 09, one of the more entertaining things I used to do, I got hold of an old map of Kabul, and I liked reminding my colleagues that ISAF headquarters and a lot of the area around the airport is right inside the old cantonment from the Second Anglo-Afghan War. We may not know that, but the Afghans know that. So there's a...
We get a lot of stuff. You know, the Afghans are very tough people when it comes to foreign invasions. But there are a couple of really great books out now with Graveyard of Empires in the title, one by my friend David Isby and another one by Seth Jones. But the truth of the matter is, Afghanistan has not really been the graveyard of empires. A lot of empires have come through and ultimately have had their way with the Afghans, and it's generally they thought the juice wasn't worth the squeeze. Well, then they left. But in the meantime, when they hung around, they were able to just sort of grab a hold of the major lines of communication in the major cities, and even if the countryside remained out of their control. Of course, for most of the rulers of Kabul, the countryside has remained out of their control in any case. So, the foreign visitors have had sort of a similar problem that was endured by all the leaders of Afghanistan.
Yeah, I still recommend the same book that I was handing out to some of my JOs after the package came in to Bahrain back in late 2001. I think Hopkirk's The Great Game. If people want to reach back and see how the echo of history can keep hitting on the same topics, I think that's another great tome that anybody who's going to find themselves ordered into that AOR probably needs to get hold of and read, just to get a little more depth than maybe things that have been written in the last 11 or 12 years. And going back to kind of some of our recent history, and ISAF, the NATO operation, we talk a lot about influencers and the tribal aspects and the sub-tribal aspects of Afghanistan, their ethnic groups. Well, NATO has its own problem with tribalism as well. And back when I was there in 08 and 09, that was when the uplift of forces was just starting. Regional Command South was a UK, Canadian, Dutch fiefdom, even though the Dutch and Canadians had already announced at that time they were going home. And there was a lot of worry inside of NATO with the old flags to post concerns that you see there, the re-Americanization of especially RC South. So we come to middle part of the fighting season in 2012, and American forces, especially the Marines in RC South, and also have commander of RC South since I think 2011 or 2010, one of the two. How has that impacted in the intervening 3 years, mostly British, but generally our European NATO allies' view of the ISAF operation from where it was when the uplift of forces began in late in 08?
Yeah, a very important point, and important to stress to people who think that somehow Afghanistan has become the new Iraq. We've got 50 countries helping us in Afghanistan. In our trip there of less than 10 days, we encountered Brits in many various forms, Canadians, both Army and police. We were flown around by Brits, Danes, Germans, and we went out west, and out west, the ISAF commitment out west, every now and then you would see an American on the staff of the Italian general that runs the show out there in the Herat area, and also a large presence of Spanish soldiers out there as well. In 2009, when Barack Obama took over, there were 38,000 American troops, which had been plussed up over the last few years of the Bush administration, and there were 30,000 NATO troops, or other ISAF partner troops. So it was a fairly balanced coalition. In March, the president added 20,000, and then by the end of the year decided to surge forces there, which added another 30,000 Americans with 10,000 ISAF non-American troops thrown in on top of that. And by the time we were finished with that, turned around in the early part of 2010 and found out that we had a force there slightly over 140,000. And one of the reasons that great force was there, a lot of effort was being put not only to fighting the enemy all about, but also a lot of effort was being put into drastically increasing the size of the Afghan forces, which has been successful. The Army and the police went from a low 200,000 to now almost 350,000, building to a maximum of 352,000. So they're getting ready, and a huge amount of money, of course, went into this too. The 3 years before the Obama surge, we were averaging about $48 billion a year. Now we're averaging nearly, the 3 years since, we've averaged way over $100 billion a year. So a lot of money has gone in, a lot of good results. The Allies are right now, they're tireder than we are. They have less public support and always have had less public support for the war than we have. And many of them have very small and underfunded armies. The economic crisis in Europe is going to take a toll. And when we finally get around to redesigning the post-2014 advise and assist force, we're going to have to work hard to get as good a European contribution as we've got right now. I have to say that the headquarters, back in the old days in 2002, which was my first trip to Afghanistan when I was working in the Pentagon, back then, chains of command were pretty simple. The entire contingent we had training the Afghan National Army were two Green Beret A teams and the staff of a B team. Was their headquarters, and the whole thing was being commanded by a very talented lieutenant colonel. A couple of years later, there were two generals running that and a much larger staff, and today there's a command of 6,000 people and more generals and senior police officers than you can shake a stick at. But that's, in some ways, is kind of the NATO way. In an area where the United States would put one or two flag officers into a large command. The Europeans have a tendency to add folks along the way, many of whom, by the way, are just absolutely terrific and just some of the best people you ever, you're ever going to want to meet, and totally dedicated to the task of what we're doing. And so, as far as I'm concerned, Sal, one of the great parts of the Afghan operation has been the tremendous response of the allies. And there's lots to criticize there, on a number of grounds. For example, most of them stay for a much shorter period of time than our guys do, and they rotate out. And often they don't bring as much kit to the fight as we do. But, what they don't have in equipment, they make up for in effort and legitimacy. We're glad to have them there.
Let me shift focus a little bit to the Pakistanis. The U.S. and NATO allies are fighting a very much of an away game there in a isolated spot. You address this in your book, by the way, I commend to anybody who wants to read a good summary of how we got into Afghanistan and what problems we face. But one of the problems you keep addressing in that is Pakistan. Since the recent apology by Secretary of State Clinton, they've opened up the southern supply line again. But can you talk a little bit about the issues we face with Pakistan and where you might see that going down the road?
Pakistan has been in very much of an anomaly in this. It's both a friend and adversary. They are full partners with us in the war on terrorism. They have suffered more casualties in the war on terrorism and in fighting extremists on their own soil than all of the allies have taken inside of Afghanistan. But that said, part of Pakistani modus operandi is to use radical groups to pursue aspects of their foreign policy, and they've provided safe haven to the Taliban in its various forms, and they have, in some cases, used the Taliban directly were involved with the Taliban in carrying out operations inside of Afghanistan. Sad to say, in recent days, we've now found Pakistani Taliban crossing the border into isolated areas of Afghanistan in the northeast in Kunar province and operating back in Pakistan against Pakistani authorities from these little outposts that they're maintaining inside of Afghanistan. It really is an anomalous situation. The former chairman of the Joint Chiefs staked much of his reputation and a good part of his chairmanship on dealing with the Pakistanis, trying to bring them around to our way of thinking. But the truth of the matter is Pakistan is an important regional power. They have their own interests. And cooperation between the United States and Pakistan is going to be done. It's going to be done with the respect for both countries' interests. And we had a very, very bad patch in 2010 and 11, where there were a number of different circumstances where the Pakistanis were outraged at American, in their view, of course, American violations of their sovereignty. Sad to say, even the killing of Osama bin Laden was looked down upon almost as if it were an attack on Pakistani soil. And rather than being horrified that Osama bin Laden was living in a military town in the midst of one of the best neighborhoods inside of Pakistan in a general sense, instead of being horrified by that, they were horrified by the fact that we took matters into our own hands there. And then, of course, in November, late November of 2011, we had a terrible fight along the border, which in the fog of war ended up with our planes bombing a Pakistani military border post and ended up with a few dozen Pakistani soldiers killed. That, of course, shut down the ground lines of communication. One of the things I looked at this summer was, the ground lines of communication to Pakistan had been closed for 4 or 5 months. And I thought to myself, you know, one of the things you might find there is tremendous supply problems inside the country. And the answer is, couldn't find any. No supply problems. Everybody had everything they needed, including the Afghan forces, who more often than not kept their warehouses very well stocked. And so the truth of the matter was, our brilliant logisticians had been able to transition and move more and more material through the northern distribution network, which basically starts in the Baltic, goes to the Soviet Union, and then down into a couple of different countries in Central Asia and into the country. Problem for the future is two problems for the future on the lines of communication. First and foremost, very costly. The Northern Distribution Network, I'm told, and I've never seen these figures broken down, that there's somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 million dollars a month more to move supplies through the Northern Distribution Network. The real problem, I think, though, comes not so much in the inflow of supplies, but is going to come in the outflow of troops as we begin to move wholesale large numbers of troops out of the country. The amount of tonnage is going to strain both the Northern Distribution Network and the Pakistani ground lines of communication. And so, had we not reopened those lines of communication, I think we would have had some significant problems. In the meantime, I'm hoping that, the Pakistanis are also finding it an opportune time for their nation and our nation to begin to redefine our common interests and to begin to work on things like the defeat of radicals and the remnants of Al-Qaeda that are clearly in the interest of both countries. That being one thing, and also working in a different vein on reconciliation. And when things chilled over between the United States, ISAF, and Pakistan, when things went into a hard freeze, guess what stopped? All progress for reconciliation. Because nobody in the Taliban wants to get too far out of sync with Pakistan. And so now we're beginning to see reconciliation efforts at the lowest levels beginning to come back and people now talking about making peace. And this, of course, interestingly enough, is causing some infighting in the Taliban, which, of course, breaks my heart that they're now beginning to, fight amongst themselves. But in any case, I think it's a good sign that, in general, some elements of the Taliban are interested in reconciliation. And again, that's an important thing we need to work on with the Pakistanis for the future. On another front, Mr. Panetta, I think, a brilliant move, has encouraged the Indians to do more in Afghanistan. And India has a fantastic policy towards Afghanistan, basically using economic and soft power. They've really made themselves a friend of the Afghan government. They've developed their own lines of communication through the eastern part of Iran up into the southern part of the southwestern part, if you will, of Afghanistan, a completely new set of lines of communication for the future. Lots of economic assistance and whatever. This, of course, is a Pakistani nightmare, but I think it's a good object lesson for them, and that they have to know that you know, Afghanistan and also ISAF has options. And, you know, if we can't thaw things out with the Pakistan government, then we can increasingly proceed to do more and more with the Indians, who are very interested in maintaining a non-Taliban, decent, democratic government in Afghanistan. More and more every day, because their economic interests in Afghanistan are growing, you know, even as we speak.
Yeah, the few interactions I've had with PAC MIL officers, it seems you're always about 2 minutes away from talking about India before it's all said and done. So that would be a very interesting thing to watch how the Pakistanis watch that continuing evolution. An earlier part of your comments I thought was a lead into a question that myself and one of our Turkish listeners and I were thinking the same thing, Saturn V up in the chat room. It folds into back in early 2007, I had a great opportunity to meet with a, he called himself a retired Ukrainian major general, but of course he's a retired Soviet. But he was the Soviet equivalent of their CJ-2 in the mid-80s. And part of the meeting was he was describing their operational plan and the various revisions that they had on it. And in the dark humor you can only get from a retired Soviet two-star, he said, well, besides the fact that you can't level entire villages and you can't mine hillsides and valleys, our plans are very similar. And when you look at the president's December of 09 West Point speech, removed from General McKiernan's shape, clear, hold, build, conditions-based program to at least what I read as a calendar-based program. We did shift it to the right some, of course. That kind of sent a signal to the neighbors, but it's pretty clear that we're the next, you know, our CJ-4 challenge is going to be, you know, retrograde of men and material, various via ways to get out of town, so to speak. How much does the Soviet experience and their calendar-based withdrawal from Afghanistan informed ours? Specifically, how you support the remaining Afghan civil government, because when I look at the Taliban history, their idea of reconciliation is their victory and on their terms in a certain amount of time. So how do we avoid the really sad decay of the post-Soviet government, which will have the post-U.S. ISAF withdrawal from Afghanistan government?
Yeah. The Soviets militarily did two great operations inside of Afghanistan. One was the invasion, initial invasion, and the other was their withdrawal. Both of them were very well conceived and well executed. And the first thing they did when Gorbachev took over was they tried some military experimentation, but very, very quickly Gorbachev let it be known that he was interested in getting out of Afghanistan. They chose a new Afghan leader. He went from Babrak Karmal to Najibullah. Najibullah was the head of their secret service, not a very nice guy, but a very effective guy. And he built up his armed forces. He worked very closely with militias out in the field. And he also, created a sense that this was not going to be a communist government anymore. It was going to be a national unity government. Well, a lot of people saw through all of that, of course. But the truth of the matter was, when the Soviet forces left, a lot of the Mujahideen basically said, hey, look, foreign invaders are gone. Who the hell cares about who governs in Kabul? It doesn't make any difference to us up in here in Nuristan or, Pakpika province or whatever. It's just, you know, one fool after another in Kabul. As long as they're not Russian speakers, you know, we're okay. Najibullah and his government did very well against the Mujahideen groups who fought amongst themselves. Najibullah, of course, doesn't survive one thing, and that is the disintegration and the disappearance of the Soviet Union. That in December 1991, the Soviet Union goes away, which meant the big checks, the aid convoys, the shipments of everything from ammunition to flour, all of that went away starting in December. And so in the spring of 1992, Najibullah hangs it up. He tries to get out of the country. He fails.
He winds up being hung by a lamppost. That's one way of hanging it up, I guess.
Yeah. 4 years later, the Taliban got him. And it, fascinating story, they talked him out of the UN compound. And then they took him to sort of one of the main squares in Kabul and killed him in a most horrific way, which, of course, is kind of par for the course, you know, in Afghan history. But Najibullah did a great job. The Soviets had a much tougher time in Afghanistan than we do today. They were fighting the whole country in arms. The number of armed Mujahideens on the hunt in the war against the Soviet Union was many times more than the total number of the Taliban. The Soviets fought a nation in arms, motivated, tough nation in arms. We're not fighting a nation in arms. We're fighting 20,000, you know, radical insurgents who are using their tribal connections and all the money that they can muster to create havoc inside of Afghanistan. So we're obviously doing many, cosmetically speaking, we're doing many of the same things that the Soviet Union was in Afghanistan. But the essence of what the Soviet Union was doing in Afghanistan was almost the complete opposite of what we're doing there. Even down to refugees, the Soviets caused 5 million Afghans to become refugees. Most of those refugees have come back since the United States and ISAF have been there. So now for the future, there was a lot of trepidation about what this deadline of 2014 meant. And a lot of people thought, hey, that's it. The Americans are going to leave. There was a little bit of panic going on there. I think that President Obama, Secretary Panetta, and Secretary Clinton have done an awful lot in the last few months to put that panic to rest. First, they signed the Strategic Partnership Agreement, which pledged American aid out to 2024. At the Chicago summit, our NATO allies and the Afghans and the United States signed up to providing security assistance of up to $4 billion a year for the Afghans, which is enough with good management and sane operations to support their forces out into the future. One of the do-outs that we have there is designing that advise and assist force. I was hoping at Chicago that we would get more of that done, but it's still in the TBD column for General Allen and his partners in the NATO chain of command. So one more blessing that we got today was announced by Secretary Clinton en route to the Tokyo Economic Assistance Conference. She stopped in Kabul and announced that Kabul, Afghanistan, has been made a major non-NATO ally, which is going to smooth the way for a lot of security assistance and really is a declaration, one further declaration of American support post-2014. So, to make a long story short, America introduced a lot of trepidation about 2014. But I think between America and NATO, we've now convinced people that we're transitioning to an Afghan lead, but we're not leaving. We're letting the Afghans take the lead, but we're going to be behind them and helping them. And the only way, I tell people, the only way the Taliban can really win is if we quit. And in the last few months, we've made it very clear that 2014 is going to be a watershed, but it doesn't mean that the West is quitting on Afghanistan. We quit once before on Afghanistan in 1990, and 10 years later we got payback for it in the form of the 9/11 attacks on the United States. And I think everybody in the government today remembers that. So they're fighting hard to keep the fight going post 2014.
This is probably a good time to segue into your Armed Forces Journal article on searching for a strategy. You raise a lot of really good questions about what the future is going to look like for the U.S. and its defense forces. Could you kind of, for the benefit of people who haven't read that yet, could you kind of go over that a little bit and talk about where you see things going and what the major issues are?
Sure. I think there are lots of great issues. I mean, just a year or two ago, people were saying, you know, we're in the era of persistent low-intensity conflict or words to that effect, and that, we will be operating in Iraq and Afghanistan for years at a clip, and otherwise we will be doing other things along the low-intensity conflict front. Well, Iraq, it certainly hasn't gone away, but it's gone its own path. And, you know, we've got a minor security assistance effort there and still have a few hundred troops in Iraq, by the way. Don't forget our men and women over there. But Afghanistan now also winding down. And so strategically, the United States has decided, initially they were saying pivot, but now they're saying rebalance in the direction of Asia Pacific, which is an area that, truth be told, we never really left. And, I certainly think all of those things make sense. But the tough nut here is we're talking about, you know, doing new and important things in Asia Pacific, which is a very, very demanding area of operations, especially for the Air Force and the Navy. It requires top-notch naval gear, ships, planes, whatever, and also the Air Force to get serious about things like new bombers and whatever, and basing arrangements all around. Problematical. But we're trying to do all of that in an era where we're cutting, at the very least, $500 billion out of the defense budget. And that's a scary amount of money, but if you have sequestration, you may be way in excess of that, perhaps up to $1 trillion over 10 years coming out of the budget. And those are serious curtailments on what we've been doing. A number of people who are very smart historians or strategists have basically said, well, what we need to do is to downscope our strategy. You know, we need to move away from the strategy of forward deployment and engagement, and we need to develop a new strategy, maybe a strategy of being an offshore balancer or things like that. I spent some time in the article talking about how that's probably not a good idea, and how the basic strategy that we have right now is a good strategy. There's nothing wrong with engagement. There's nothing wrong with forward deployed forces. Indeed, the biggest thing the United States has going for it is this incredible network of allies we have all around the world. And that comes in large measure because of shared strategic interests and engagement. We're working together all the time. And we see this at the National War College all the time. Our guys go overseas. Whatever country you go to, you'll find people who graduated from the National War College or our sister college, the Industrial College of the Armed Forces, right there at Fort Benning there with us. We'll find them all over the place, all throughout the NATO countries, in Mongolia, in Japan, dozens of them in Korea, wherever we go. And so this is an incredibly important part of engagement that we do. And there's nothing wrong with forward deployed forces. There's nothing wrong with an engagement. The real issue for the future is prudence. You have to make good decisions. You have to avoid bad decisions. It's almost like, running the household accounts and the family checkbook. You've got to put your money where, the most important priorities are, and you've got to find ways of doing things in an autonomy, a force fashion, in areas where you don't. And I think the ace in the hole here, in addition to prudence, is allies, because, we are blessed tremendously, particularly in Asia-Pacific, with a fantastic range of allies, some of whom have sort of come back to life and are now pursuing dormant relationships with the United States that have either never really developed or have been dormant for a few years. We've recently had our first graduate of the National War College from Vietnam, fantastic officer. Mr. Panetta has visited Vietnam, and had very deep conversations with the people there. There's also tremendous influence, interest rather, in the Philippines in, reigniting the fires of our once extremely close relationship. And part of this comes from the fact that everybody's looking around and they're going, what does a world with a large and powerful China look like? Well, if you're a small country in East Asia or South Asia, or even you're a big country like India in South Asia, you need to hedge your bets on that. Nobody wants to fight China. China doesn't want to fight anybody. But the truth of the matter is, you've got great powers, and you've got to all be prepared to both, number one, keep the peace, but number two, also to secure your national interest. And that's going to require engagement. It's going to require a lot of forward deployed forces. And most of all, it's going to require prudent decision making in Washington. We cannot afford to make mistakes like we did in 2003. We had to go into Afghanistan because of 9/11. We made a mistake in Iraq. Probably nearly a $1 trillion mistake in terms of direct costs. 20, 30 years from now, people may look at the Iraq operation and say, wow, that caused a lot of great things to happen, and ultimately, 2 decades after we left, roses began to bloom in the desert. I hope that all of those, rosy predictions are true. I'm just not sure that that's the case. I think that for the longest time, people are going to look at Iraq as a tough situation. So prudence is the answer in determining commitments. And, prudence also requires that you sort of scope your commitment to the available assets and move the assets where they need to be and decide to do things on the cheap. In the field of counterinsurgency, we're going to be involved in counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, and related things to include, you know, dealing with the nexus of insurgency, terrorism, and narcotics. We're going to be involved with that for, you know, decades to come. Truth is, we've been involved with it for decades that are behind us. But, you know, there's all sorts of ways of dealing with that. And, you know, the use of large-scale expeditionary forces for counterinsurgency is a method that you want to use in very, very rare circumstances. More often than not, you know, the best way to do counterinsurgency is what I've come to call coin light. You know, you get on the ground early with advisors and security assistants, and you help people to solve their own problems. And by the way, that's where we're ending up in Afghanistan. So I think that, you know, that bodes well for the future.
I think prudence isn't a word that we talk about much in the field of arms. Everybody likes to quote Napoleon's audacity, audacity, audacity. But you've got to balance it with prudence, because there's Moscow, there's Elba, there's Waterloo, and then there's a slow death by arsenic if you don't have a little bit of prudence in there. And
absolutely. My favorite on the audacity prudence front is George Armstrong Custer. And the truth is, at the Little Bighorn, he did what he did 20 times before, and it worked for him 20 out of 21 times. You know, it was just that, you know, in the last instance, he got way out, you know, behind beyond the capabilities of his troops against an enemy that was much more capable than he had anticipated. And so, you know, we've got to avoid situations like that. And, you know, whenever possible, you know, almost in a way, you know, in sort of imitation of the Nixon doctrine, you know, we've got to be able to help people against terrorists, insurgents, narco-terrorists, and other forms of organized crime and whatever, and we've got to do it, you know, in a tailored way, in a way that makes sense for the amount of stuff available and for the strength of our interest in any one particular areas. And I'm happy to say that we are finally in Afghanistan after 3 years of huge expenditures, you know, redesigning our program there to accomplish our interests at a much lower level of expenditure. And those are the sorts of things that we're going to have to do for the future to get smart. And I think that we've had it really inspired leadership. I mean, Secretary Gates and Secretary Panetta, these are people who, they hit so many home runs, you know, all of the great records of government service are up for grabs. These are people who have done things consistently right, and they've done well. Also, our last few chairmen have been wonderful players with a great strategic mentality and have done a great job in leading the armed forces, which are now at the point of you know, they've never been used like this before in their history. And so, you know, one of the things we also have to do in keeping with prudence is, you know, make sure that, you know, our equipment is being well tended to and refurbished, that new equipment is being bought, and that we pay a lot of attention to the human aspect. And our people, in the old cavalry expression, have been ridden hard and put up wet. By the way, that started before 9/11. You know, the armed forces, people were complaining about being deployed too much before 9/11.
Oh, yeah, I didn't have bright, shiny equipment in August of 2001, I can guarantee you that. The equipment thing is interesting because I think there's a habit. People always want to grab hold of a buzzword or a single concept and say, this is what we're going to wrap the future around. But in your article, Searching for a Strategy, I liked a point you brought up in the third paragraph where you said, the issue is not about developing or managing a single force, but four forces at once. What are those four forces, and why is the answer four, not one?
Well, you know, it's really sort of that issue is really the issue that faces the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the service secretaries and the service chiefs. You know, it's four forces. Today's force fighting the war, the next force 5 to 7 years out, and that force right there, we're buying equipment for that force right now. And then you have the force after next out to 20 years. And that's the long-range force. I mean, you know, if you want a complex piece of equipment, say a new bomber or whatever, that could take, you know, 10, 15, even 20 years to bring on. And then, of course, we also have to bow down to the past force, because that force also has a claim on defense resources. Planners are going to have to think hard about things like retiree and veterans benefits. And then you have all kinds of tensions. You know, if you really want to keep faith with the past commitments, you're going to have to take, you know, funds and resources that you would be using for your current or your future force to sort of get to that past force there and to maintain faith with veterans and their widows and widowers. And it's tough. The four forces is really the management problem that the senior-most people in the Pentagon are having to deal with. In retrospect, the combatant commanders in the field have it easier because their job is the current fight and shaping the next few years ahead. They don't have to deal with all, you know, these other, you know, the longer term forces. And of course, you know, there's an awful lot of weight on their shoulders too.
Well, I really enjoyed this today, Joe, and I hope you come back on our show again. I think we could ask questions for another 2 weeks and get great answers out of you. What's the future hold for you? What can we look forward to seeing from you pretty soon?
I hope the future holds for me that I continue to teach at the National War College. I am in the enviable position of being within hand grenade range of 40 years of service, all of which has been to the Department of Defense. And every day at the National War College, in my classroom, the future walks through the door. First class that I taught as a visiting professor at the National War College in 1995, I had some really smart guys in that class, and some of them were quite memorable. And I think there were three or four four-star generals in that one class, one of which I grew to know a bit and to appreciate the depth of, his skills and intelligence was Marine General John Kelly down at Southcom, who just about is the epitome of a great general officer. And I have sort of exposure to those people every day, and so I consider myself to have one of the great jobs that any old soldier, old scholar is capable of having. So I hope that's what I'm doing for the next few years.
Well, I tell you what, it has been a real pleasure to have you here, Joe. And I want to leave you with a little parting gift. One of our usual suspects here, Lieutenant Commander B.J. Armstrong, he's a Hilo pilot, but we don't hold it against him. You talk about good, sharp young officers. One of the great characteristics of them is they marry well. And over in the chat room, I tried to give him credit, but being a well-trained husband, he gave credit to his wife. Here's a prudence quote for you that I think an Army man like yourself will appreciate. This is a quote from General Omar Bradley, quote, "If we continue to develop our technology without wisdom or prudence, our servant may prove to be our executioner." I like that. I'm going to use that.
Okay. All right. And tell me again, how much are we paying for each version of the Joint Strike Fighter? I'm not sure.
Don't get me started. I think sometimes joint subject for a different day. I hope you
have a great to hear you, Sal.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you too, and all the best, Mark. Bye.
Great.
Thank you.
And join us live again next week when our guest will be author R.L. Crossland, Captain, United States Navy, retired. I appreciate it. Hope everybody is having a great Navy day.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary.